This is episode 333 of That Shakespeare Life. Just like the work of William Shakespeare, That Shakespeare Life is supported by our patrons. Listeners like you can support the work we do here and access special insider extras. Learn more at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Crystal Lake, author of the forthcoming book, Artifact. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
Shakespeare actually is responsible for our misunderstanding about the average age of marriage in the early modern period.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
You may be surprised to learn that marriage in the 16th century was not required, nor a foregone conclusion for all women of this time period. In addition to spinsters, who were women that had never been married, there were widows that lost their husband, women who were separated from their husbands, and still some women who our guest this week calls never married women. A never married woman chose to never get married at all and also provided for themselves financially. While Shakespeare doesn't use the phrase never married to talk about women, he does talk about spinsters, widows, prostitutes, and even divorce, reflecting the society of his time period. While all versions of single women in Shakespeare's lifetime operated outside of what we generally expect for the 16th century, the reality is that being single and even women who were independently made occupied a much larger section of society than you may have assumed. Here today to tell us about the single ladies of the 16th century and what it was like for a woman who never married is our guest, Amy Freud. Amy Freud is professor of history and chair of the history department at UMBC. She teaches courses in British history, women's history, and early modern European history. Her most recent book is Silent Partners, Women as Public Investors During Britain's Financial Revolution. She is also the author of Never Married, Single Women in Early Modern England, and co-editor of Single Women in the European Past from 1250 to 1800. Professor Freud also holds affiliate appointments in gender, women's and sexuality studies, and the Language, Literacy, and Culture PhD program. Learn more about Amy Freud and all of her work and links to some of her books in the show notes for today's episode. Hello, Amy. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Thank you very much for having me, Cassidy. Excited to be here.
What was the average age of marriage for women during Shakespeare's lifetime?
Well, I'd like to tell my students that Shakespeare actually is responsible for our misunderstanding about the average age of marriage in the early modern period, especially for Britain. A lot of this has to do with his plays like Romeo and Juliet, where you have young people who are in their teens courting and contemplating marriage. And in actuality, people in early modern England, people living at Shakespeare's time, would have married much later. So the average woman would have probably entered marriage or a first marriage at the age of 25 or 26. And for men, it's even a little bit later, maybe age 27, 28.
That's surprising, especially because Anne Hathaway was 26 when she married William Shakespeare. And I've always thought she was older, probably because William was only 18 at the time. So it was actually him that was unusually young, as opposed to Anne Hathaway being unusually old.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we should take Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway not as a representative couple. They actually did something that was frowned on at the time. The norm was that the husband would be a couple years older than the wife, that this would be a little bit easier for running a patriarchal household if he was actually her superior in age. And so this inversion, which of course we know had to do with perhaps having a baby coming, was actually not the norm at the time. But it is interesting that the married couples were in England were getting married around the same age. So there's not a usually a big difference in the ages of husbands and wives. That was much more common in Southern Europe, which of course is where Romeo and Juliet takes place. And you see this young nubile teenage women being married off to older men. It's also more common, frankly, for elite people to marry younger. There was a lot more dynastic emphasis on those marriages. And we have a tendency to extrapolate what the elite did to all people when the elite were maybe less than 1% of the population.
Amy's work points out that the relatively late age of women to marry meant that a good percentage of the labor force in England was actually held by women prior to marriage. So since the average age was about 26, before then, while they were adults, women were entering the workforce. Amy, tell us about single women in Shakespeare's lifetime who were holding a pretty strong place in the workforce for this time period, and what kind of jobs were they holding?
We have another misconception that women didn't work in the past. And actually, women's historians have really been proving that to be incorrect. But one of the periods of a woman's life cycle when she was working would be when she was working as a single woman. And this really began for people in Shakespeare's age around the mid-teens. So around age 14, 15, 16, the assumption is that both boys and girls would become less dependent on their parents and more independent. Now, in England, it was very common for young men and women to go and move into another household as servants or as apprentices. And so they would begin earning wages. And this was common for single women to perhaps work for up to a decade. The nice thing about being a servant is one could actually save some of one's wages if one was thrifty. And so since they were receiving room and board, we know that many young single women actually were saving their wages and even investing that money. So I've actually done some work looking at the investments that women of pretty average status were making. So they would lend their £2 or £3 a year or invest in sheep. And this was a way for them to help amass their own dowry.
That is really surprising. That's not at all the story that we hear. You know, we're told that it was just the boys that were setting up in apprenticeships and that marriage was the goal for young women, that they didn't actually have jobs. So I'm excited that there's primary documents that demonstrate that there were women sort of bucking the assumptions we have about this. Now, we know that not all women who were single chose to be single simply as a holdover until they were married. But Amy, tell us about some of the women who chose to remain unmarried for their entire lives. So they were not just working until they got married or setting up their dowry, but they actually chose to maintain their own independent means. What were these women like?
That's right. I mean, in my work on single women, I distinguish between what I call life cycle single women and lifelong single women. So in Shakespeare's time, there were a lot of women who were single for a period of their adulthood before they married. That was probably the ideal, the stereotypical assumption. But in actuality, not all women married when they hit their mid-20s or late 20s. In fact, we think between 13 and 25% of both men and women were remaining single in the late 16th century and into the 17th century, when really we see the high point of single people. So the question becomes, what happens for a woman who doesn't end up marrying? How does she support herself? How does she live independently? And there were both obstacles and opportunities. So in later medieval and early modern England, some towns were not very welcoming to single women who wanted to live independently and who wanted to work on their own. In fact, in 1584, the town of Manchester railed against, quote, women who be unmarried, who be at their own hands. And in Coventry, a little bit earlier, single women were fixated on, especially those who took or kept houses or rooms to themselves. So I don't want to paint a picture of how easy it was for single women to establish themselves. But as historians, we have a tendency to view those kind of assertions a little bit skeptically, read them against the grain. And what it shows us is that women in Manchester and Coventry were living and working on their own. And so that was why there was a need for a statement about it. I think most of the women who are living and working in early modern towns are going into two fields. So one would be service. And we have misconceptions about service as well. We think of Downton Abbey and we think domestic servants. But in the early modern period, servants were more extra hands, extra labor. And they were put to a lot of different jobs in the household. So they might actually help run a shop or run a workshop. We know that actually a lot of early modern childcare was done by these servants to help the married mother of the household. And the other area that a lot of single women were engaged in was the textile trade. So they were engaged in sewing and weaving and producing cloth, as well as other accessories for clothing.
So we're talking about these women that are choosing to not get married, but I want to address a particular kind of single woman known as a spinster. Amy, I think we're familiar with this term here, but perhaps out of context for what it was meant in Shakespeare's lifetime. For clarity's sake, explain for us how your work wants us to think about spinsters, both in the context of Shakespeare's lifetime, as well as being distinct from other kinds of women who decided never to get married.
Actually, the term spinster doesn't really emerge until really the 1600s. It's a neutral term. It's a descriptor legal term for a woman who either hasn't married or has never married. And we see it in documents like wills and tax purposes. We see that term used. It's not seen negatively. It doesn't have a negative connotation. It's a descriptive term like bachelor. Interestingly, bachelor always remains more of a neutral, even positive term. And over the 1700s, we see spinster start to become a more negative term. And that's the connotation that we have today. So when we put ourselves back into Shakespeare's time, that wouldn't have been necessarily the case. There was actually maybe an acceptance, a realization that some women did not marry and that there needed to be a way to understand them, categorize them. This is a world that loves to categorize people, put people in boxes. Recent research has also shown us that some of the women who were working single women were actually not all English. So we have now records that we found of people of African descent in Tudor England. And one of them included a woman named Catalina. We don't have a last name for her. Her first name seems to indicate that she was of Spanish origin. And we know that many people of African descent entered from that route from Spain. She was recorded living in a small village, the village of Almondsbury in Gloucestershire. And she died in 1625. And we have an inventory of her belongings, which show us that she had a cow from which she was able to supply milk and butter to her neighbors. She doesn't have much else listed in the inventory, so she seems to have lodged with someone else, perhaps the widow, who was the executor of her will. And in this case, this would be an example of what we call spinster clustering, single women and widows living together and making a life. It's interesting for me to think about that the fact that some single women in early modern England would have been from a multi-ethnic, multiracial background, and that single women were a group that was common across these different immigrants coming to England at the time.
Well, speaking of those boxes, what was the cultural reception and place for women of independent means? And I think I want to compare this to someone like a widow who might have been seen as a type of charity case or someone that society needed to support because she was single, not of her choosing. Whereas I presume there was no such charitable opinion towards a woman who your work calls a never married woman who decided she was going to support herself on independent means. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, I think today we think of women as either married or unmarried. And in my work, I argue for the early modern period, that's not the case, that actually there's more in common between women who married and widows, who I call ever married women, and single women who have never married, who I call never married women, therefore. Widows had done their job in early modern England. They had married, they had perhaps produced children, and as such, they earned social credibility and the right to be assisted. Whereas single women were seen, especially after the Reformation, as selfish, as deviating from the appropriate path. And so single women began to be thought of in a pejorative way, that they were perhaps selfish, too independent, had avoided their role as a wife and a mother, and also were not productive. They were not producing children. And so this is where we start to see this idea of the selfish old maid start to emerge. In Shakespeare's time, we actually see the proverb that's very common in the early modern period that equates single women with leading apes in hell. And this proverb shows up in Much Ado About Nothing and in The Taming of the Shrew to describe female characters who may be thinking about choosing a life of singleness, and that their punishment for doing so, they literally would be punished, would be to go to hell, so they would not be saved, and they would be partnered with apes. That tells us a lot about what people in Shakespeare's time thought about single women, right?
That's a significant amount of hate there. Like, that's, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking, right? And I see that suspicion and hatred of single women actually only grow. So this is really the beginning of that. And you see it grow throughout the 17th century until by the 18th century, old maids are talked about as diseased and polluted. We see the origins of that in Shakespeare's plays even.
Amy's work uses the adjective superannuated to describe another category of single women, which are the virgins of society. Amy, explain for the uninitiated here what superannuated means and why it was important to apply this adjective to the understanding of virgin women for Shakespeare's lifetime.
So you probably know the term old maid or the term spinster, but my favorite is always superannuated virgin, which means old virgin or past one's prime virgin. Superannuated is always a term when it was used that was negative. And it's also a joke, right? A maid should be young and nubile and desirable, but a superannuated maid or virgin is past one's cell date. And we see that this term actually comes into being even earlier than we may have thought. One of the first instances I've seen is a letter from 1619 where a man makes reference to a superannuated virgin in a negative way. So people at Shakespeare's time would have known this was a kind of funny term for this new category of woman who is single past her 20s.
Well, I know we would love to explore the life of women in Shakespeare's lifetime, especially these single women who are providing for themselves. This is really exciting sort of section of history that I don't think we realized was there. If we want to explore this type of history, and especially if we want to explore the stories of real individuals from this time period who fall into this category, where should we look? And what are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we start with?
For shameless self-promotion, I would recommend a couple of my own books. I wrote a book called Never Married, which looks at exactly these type of women in England from the 16th through the 18th centuries. And I also co-edited a collection with Judith Bennett called Single Women in Early Modern Europe. So if you're interested in a more comparative look as well. There are two early modern women writers who were single women themselves, who devoted their lives to celibacy. And I think we get a sense of how they felt about singleness, which was actually quite positive. So I think it's important to look at women's words themselves. So I recommend the poetry of Jane Barker, who lived a bit later than Shakespeare, but she wrote a poem called A Virgin Life. And in this poem, she tells us that she hopes she can remain fearless of turning 25, which indicates to us that 25 is an age where a woman might transfer or transition from being a life cycle to a lifelong single woman. And Jane Barker actually thought that the life of a single woman could be very productive and positive. And she talked about the charity that such women could do, the assistance they could bring to their neighbors and their family. So it's a very positive view of singleness. It's not an unfulfilled life. But the other person I would like your listeners to know about is the single woman Mary Estelle, who is considered one of the first feminists in early modern England. And she wrote a number of treatises where, again, she was defending a single life. She argued that women, if they could only find inadequate partners, should actually choose singleness over an unhappy marriage. And she advocated for building female academies in which women could live and reside together and continue their learning and continue an honorable life. Some people have said this is basically a Protestant nunnery. And I think it's interesting to think about the fact that women in the early modern period were conceptualizing how one would live a single life.
Well, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be in addition to those.
So I laughed at this question because I hate choosing one of anything. I'm somebody who loves everything. But I think what I would like to bring is actually the book that set me on my path to being a historian of women in the early modern period. And you're going to laugh. This was a very bawdy, racy novel that was released in the mid 20th century called Forever Amber. And it's really a progenitor to the historical fiction and historical romance we all love today. So I want people to go back and check out Forever Amber, which was written by Anya Seton, and learn about a single woman in 17th century England.
We will make sure to link to that in the show notes for today's episode. And I understand totally not wanting to take just one book to your deserted island, especially when you study books for a living. You're like, no, I need my library. Let's just box it up.
My library would not fit on a desert island.
Well, what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
I think you can see that I enjoy looking at topics that maybe haven't been talked about a lot or researched a lot. And I'm still interested in marital status, actually, 25 years on. So now I'm starting to work on a new category of women. We have assumed that in the past, women were either unmarried, married, or widowed. And in actuality, in early modern England, there were also a lot of women who were separated wives. So I'm starting to work on separated wives. Today, we would call them divorcees, but in early modern England, there was no possibility for divorce. And so a couple that could no longer live together could go to a church court and ask for a legal separation, which allowed them to reside separately, live separate lives, usually came with some kind of maintenance for the wife, but the couple could not remarry. They were still married in the eyes of the church, in the eyes of God. So it doesn't mean that some people didn't repartner themselves, but marriage was actually not something that could be found, at least publicly or licitly.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for being here. We will look forward to hearing about your work that explores the lives of separated wives, because we have really enjoyed looking at the lives of never married women. And just this section of history is really exciting. And I appreciate you being here to share this history with us.
This was so much fun. Thank you, Cassidy. I love the idea of exploring Shakespeare's world and all its many nuances. And so I think that it's important for you to think about the fact that there were not only single women on the stage, but single women in the audiences hearing those same plays.
Thank you so much. The list of resources and recommendations we've been talking about today, including links to where you can learn more about Jane Barker and the other single women that Amy mentions today from the early modern period, will be included in the show notes for today's episode. You can find these at cassidycash.com/episode333. If you'd like to see more visual history related to our conversation today, including portraits, primary documents, and museum artifacts that I can round up about today's conversation, be sure to check out the detailed show notes available for patrons. You can access these detailed show notes right from the regular show notes page by clicking on the Become a Patron button. There, you can either join us as a patron or log in if you're already a supporter of the show, and all of these extra content will expand right there on the page. Again, that URL for today's show is cassidycash.com/episode333. That's cassidycash.com/EP333. That Shakespeare Life is powered by our patrons. Patrons get access to our library of bonus content like detailed show notes and our video streaming library, plus substantial discounts on merchandise and our online history content. Each week, patrons drive the work we do here with an insider's look to the making of our show, including sneak peeks at upcoming guests and the chance to submit your questions you'd like asked during an interview. If you love learning history here with us each week and you'd like to go that extra step to support our work and be a part of the making of our show, then consider becoming a patron today. You can learn more and sign up right now at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.